listening to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, hunters and anglers contribute big bucks each year towards research in conservation biology. And that's through an organization unique to Alberta, called the Alberta Conservation Association. Trevor Thera outlines some of the interesting work ACA researchers are doing with bears and bull trout. And one person who won't get his nose out of joint if you complain about some smell is Dr. Richard Coleman. Armed with the 8-portal olfactometer, he puts stinky stuff in its place when it comes to hog farms and sour gas wells. And a blast from the past. Historian Michael Payne looks back at efforts to set off an atomic bomb at Cheecham Crossing, all in the name of getting oil out of the Athabasca tar sands. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. If you've purchased a hunting or fishing license this year, a portion of what you've paid goes towards research and conservation. In a situation that's unique to Alberta, the license money is funneled through the government to an organization called the Alberta Conservation Association. Over the last few years, the ACA has contributed millions of dollars towards research on Alberta's wildlife. Trevor Thera is the manager of strategic initiatives for the ACA.
The Alberta Conservation Association, or the ACA, is a charitable organization that was formed April 1st, 1997. And it was formed in order to preserve the legacy of the Alberta Fish and Wildlife Trust Fund, which has been in existence for approximately 25 years. The ACA, as of 1997, when it was born, became a delegated administrative organization. And what that is a piece of legislation under the Alberta Wildlife Act that provides the ACA with powers, duties, functions that enables it to carry out activities related to population inventories and the development enhancement of populations and habitats in Alberta.
Where does the funding come from?
The funding is primarily obtained from revenues on hunting and angling licenses, which come from sportsmen and women in Alberta. That's another part of the legislation that allows the ACA is also given the right to acquire levies on hunting and angling licenses sold in Alberta. We also have a significant amount of partner dollars each funding cycle or each year, nearly to the tune of $2 million currently, and that's mainly from industrial partners, from the oil and gas sector, the timber resource sector, and agriculture.
So what do you do with that money? What do you focus on in terms of activities?
Well, our core business, in a nutshell, is to contribute to the sustainable management of Alberta's wildlife and fish populations and the habitat upon which they depend. We don't involve ourselves with the management or the responsibility for the management of those resources, because we realize that the ACA has no role in regulating the land or resource use, and we strictly identify the Ministry of Sustainable Resource Development as having that ultimate responsibility.
Well, you're involved in a number of different research projects. What would some of those be, some of those areas you're looking at?
We fund a whole wide variety of programs related to fisheries, wildlife, habitat, and biodiversity programs. And we also deliver a great majority of these projects, as mentioned before. And some of the projects that we deliver are, for example, on the fisheries side of things, is the Cooperative Fisheries Inventory Program. We cooperatively fund this program with the timber industry in Alberta, several different companies like Weyerhaeuser, Slave Lake Pulp. Also, the ACA provides sustainable resource development managers with a variety of information related to the health of fisheries populations, and that's done through a program called our Sport Fish Monitoring Program, which allows us to sample a variety of different lakes and a variety of different fisheries populations throughout Alberta, and providing the resource managers, the government, with up-to-date, scientifically valid information on the status of those populations.
You're also putting funding towards a chair at the university. What's that about?
The ACA has committed to enter into a partnership or a relationship with the University of Alberta in developing an endowment or a trust fund with, in the hopes of developing a applied fish and wildlife research set of programs with a particular professor who they've acquired and is working at the U of A now is Dr. Mark Boyce, who's a very prominent researcher in the area of wildlife research and conservation, and who is also an avid hunter. We've provided the U of A with $3 million as an endowment fund upon which he can attract other funds, which can be directed towards research in Alberta's fish and wildlife.
Well, Mark Boyce has a number of different students, grad students, working on various projects.
Sophie Chetwerniski studying the effects of road access and management and spring baited bear hunting. Cheryl Chetkiewicz is evaluating the effects of the Canmore and Crow's Nest Pass highway corridors on grizzly bears and cougars. Travis Ripley is a graduate student who also works for the Sustainable Resource Development, a biologist taking advantage of the ACA chair in Fish and Wildlife again here in terms of professional development. And he's studying bull trout metapopulations in the Kakko River drainage.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl. My pleasure.
That was Trevor Thera, Manager of Strategic Initiatives for the Alberta Conservation Association. Coming up, a day in the life of a stink master. When Richard Coleman says his job stinks, he expresses that sentiment with great enthusiasm. That's because he makes his living sniffing out odors that cause other people to blush and faint. As a research scientist with the Alberta Research Council, Richard is working on a method that would take the subjectiveness out of judging odors. Akin to the Richter scale for earthquakes, perhaps one day if you blow an 8 on the Coleman scale, your stink just might send you to jail. One of the sniffers Richard is working with is something he calls the 8-portal olfactometer.
The olfactometer is housed, our olfactometer is housed in about a 33-foot trailer towed by a large truck. And it's a, inside there are two banks of four consoles in front of which the people sit, where they are presented with diluted odorous air, and there's a series of buttons that allow them to respond to whatever it is that they are smelling.
So what is it that you actually present to them in terms of smelling? Do you have to go through different levels in order to get a response?
We collect samples in large plastic bags. The bags are connected to the machine, and then we produce a very dilute sample or that is presented to the panel members by diluting the sample air with cleaned air produced through various filters.
How is it that people respond? Because I would think, you know, some things that some people don't smell, other people react very badly to. So how do you deal with that subjective sense of how people smell stuff?
First of all, when we select panel members, they go through a course where it evaluates their ability to smell things at certain levels. And we have compounds that we use which are generally accepted by the industry as not really a standard but a sensitivity level detector. Once they've been accepted for that, the ability to detect these materials, they are then trained in smelling and how they should respond.
You're doing this for clients using the olfactometer. Who would those clients be, or could you give me an example of why they would even come to you to get some sort of reading of what their stink or smell level problem is?
First of all, our clients are many and varied. They can be government agencies, they can be lobby groups, they can be municipalities, they can be farms themselves, and they can be technology developers. And what they want to know is what the odor level is in an objective manner of their particular operation or situation. If a feedlot operator or a municipality was to come to us to ask to determine the odor, we would prescribe how they would collect the sample, or we would do it for them, bring the sample back, and of course put it through our process. The numbers, the odor numbers developed from this process would be sent back to the client, and they would make the necessary changes. If it were a feedlot, for instance, they might change their management routine in the feedlot to allow them to reduce odor. And typically, we would then get a second set of samples to look at the effectiveness of this management change in feedlot operation. We might also see a farm that is developing. And we have such a client right now where before the farm went in, on the raw land, odor samples were taken across a matrix or a very large area that area would contain the farm in the future. And through the development of this farm, and it was a pig farm, odor samples were taken until the point that the barn was fully populated and operational. And through that time period, one could see the changes in what happened during the design, construction, population, and operation of this pig farm. And the results are actually quite revealing, and you can see exactly what happens during the bringing on of production of a pig farm. They then saw the impact of the farm and started to bring in technologies that would, or management techniques that would reduce odor production. And this was actually very revealing. But typically when we get samples, the results go back, and the individuals, the clients that we have, often make changes. And then they like to reevaluate what it is or what the impacts might have been of those changes made. So,
what might be some of the things then that they could do to reduce odor?
On feedlots, probably removing manure at a more scheduled time rather than leaving it sit around. Provide better drainage of water from rains and snows. For pig farms, making sure that things are kept washed down, making sure that you optimize air passing through barns so that you don't impact as much the surrounding environment. During the storage of manures, perhaps covering manure storage pits, or injecting or spreading the manure more frequently. There's many, many things that can be done. And the way to really evaluate how effective odor production has been reduced is only by doing odor analysis. And this is where the 8-port olfactometer does come in. And I think it seems, well, I'm convinced it's very effective. So.
You're moving into some other areas as well, and I understand that you're in the development stages of an electronic nose. What's that?
Electronic noses are devices that, when presented with odorous air, this air contains what we call volatile molecules, and when these molecules interact with the detectors in these electronic noses, we see a response in the detector output. The electronic noses to date are very much like olfactometers in they only sample a particular sample or a particular point in time. So overall, we will not be able to see odor production and then odor decline, and we won't be able to describe an odor event very well. What we're trying to do is to allow an electronic nose to emulate a human nose. We have in the past demonstrated that we can train these electronic noses to emulate the human nose so that a response from the electronic nose would be similar to a response from an olfactometer. We also are developing these electronic noses to sense or smell odors in real time. So over a 24-hour period, these electronic noses will be smelling continuously. This will then allow companies or farms the ability to see when an odor event occurs and then relate that back to their processes within the industry so that a modification can be made to minimize that odor event.
What are some of the further applications of the electronic nose?
Well, beyond the agricultural industry, we're looking at the oil and gas industry. They are fraught with problems, particularly in the sour gas industry and in the petrochemical refining aspects. The other possibility or possibilities are sniffing packages as they come through the mail across borders for illicit substances, perhaps even determining the presence of bacterial infections in humans or other beings, and any other application where we have the production of what we call volatile molecules, these molecules that are distributed through the air. These electronic noses could be sniffing those air environments all the time, in real time, and possibly online, so that people managing that situation, be it a farm or a border crossing, they would know exactly when they see or when the electronic nose sees those molecules that are odorous.
So along with having one of those metal detectors at the airport, when you go through the airport gate, they might also be taking an electric nose to you.
One can see a large stylized nose alongside the electronic metal detectors that are actually sniffing. Yes, it's a possibility.
Are there regulations that govern the area of smell? A lot of the complaints appear to be nuisance-related, but is there anything like any big club that can come down and actually say you cannot exceed this level of smell or odor?
Well, first of all, odors are nuisance, you're right, and they are regulated by the impact of these odors on the quality of life. So they're very subjective and need to be determined usually in a court of law. So what we're trying to do is to allow them to perhaps be more objective. But to answer your question specifically, are there any regulations that say that thou shalt not go beyond a particular odor level, which is defined by a number? No, there are not right now.
What is the trend? Is this becoming more and more of a problem, the odors?
I believe so, particularly in the agricultural industry and in the oil and gas industry. Agriculture, as farms get larger and larger and people become more focused on what it is that they are farming, they become specialized. And often there are situations where grain farmers and hog farmers come to disagreement over odors and what is acceptable. At the same time, people on hobby farms and acreages seem to be concerned over odor, and there also appears to be a heightened sensitivity to odors by those that are living in the country but not farming. I think this situation is going to become worse, and it'll get to the point where we actually have to regulate this so that everybody appears to be happy.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Richard Coleman is a research scientist with the Alberta Research Council, and he's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutritional Sciences at the University of Alberta. Next, a step back in time. With all the activity in Alberta's oil sands, just be glad this isn't the 1950s. Back then, some very important people were absolutely convinced that they could release the oil by blasting it with atomic bombs. And Cheecham Crossing near Fort McMurray was picked as the test site for the first detonation. Historian Dr. Michael Payne relates one of the more bizarre stories from Alberta's oil sands history.
The story behind this project really begins in the 1950s, when the American Atomic Energy Commission started to get interested in the possible peaceful uses of nuclear weapons in engineering projects of various sorts. They worked very closely with the University of California's Lawrence Radiation Laboratory at Livermore as well on these particular ideas. For a long time, it had been known, obviously, that nuclear weapons can shift vast amounts of material. And there had been a number of engineers and scientists who'd done calculations that showed that for large-scale engineering projects, the use of nuclear weapons to move material was actually cheaper than more conventional explosives, like using dynamite, simply because of the cost of dynamite went up exponentially with the size of the project. And there'd been enough experience with above ground and underground nuclear tests since the Second World War to show, for example, that if you let off a nuclear device, you could move vast amounts of material and create what they like to refer to as harbors or things like that. They'd blown up the better part of several atolls in the South Pacific and so on. And so there was some sense that, you know, that you could use nuclear weapons to excavate harbors, dig canals. Some people had speculated that you could use them to clear underwater obstructions in shipping lanes. In other words, you wouldn't necessarily have to dredge harbors and so on anymore. And there were some other ideas as well that people thought that, you know, some other ways in which you could use this enormous power of atomic and hydrogen bombs for good in the world, if you like.
Was there some sort of name or policy from the government that actually legitimized all of this?
Yes, there was. The United States Atomic Energy Commission in 1957 began to explore the possibilities of the use of nuclear devices in engineering projects. And in 1958, they announced what they called Project Plowshare. The program was announced by Edward Teller, who was then the director of the Livermore Lab, and a man who is generally credited by nuclear historians as being the architect of the hydrogen bomb. He announced this program at a World Congress on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. It was held in Geneva in 1958. And the idea behind the program was that different groups would be able to come forward to the United States Atomic Energy Commission to suggest engineering projects that would test the value of nuclear explosions in various types of peaceful applications. This program, actually, with its rather Orwellian name, I think, of Project Plowshares, was used to justify a total of, there's some debate as to how many explosions were actually took place under it, but there's between 27 and 35 underground nuclear explosions took place between 1961 and 1973, testing various aspects of this program. And there were a number of engineering ideas that came forward for possible inclusion into this program. In 1958, actually, the Financial Post in Canada published a very interesting article which detailed some of those ideas that grew out of American testing in the Pacific and in Nevada. In addition to excavations, for example, they suggested that there was some potential for inducing various kinds of chemical reactions underground. They speculated, for example, you could produce vast amounts and infinite amounts of slaked lime, for example, setting off bombs underground, at least in theory, anyhow. So, yes, probably the biggest single project that was ever proposed under this particular scheme was there were some initial planning went into the idea of trying to redig the Panama Canal down to sea level so they wouldn't need the locks and all the expense of moving ships through the locks, getting from the Atlantic to the Pacific or the Pacific to the Atlantic. And some wag referred to this as the Panatomic Canal.
Well, given the size and scale of the Panama Canal project, and then you look to the size of the Athabasca oil sands, I guess you could begin to see that there's a connection there, certainly from a size point of view. How is it that the Alberta government got interested in nuclear power?
At this time, in the late 1950s, there was a lot of interest in the potential oil reserves of the Athabasca oil sands. But at the same time, there was a very real concern that most of the oil sand was not really suitable for development by mining, which at the time seemed to be the only more or less feasible, and there were still certainly lots of technical problems that have to be resolved there. But at the time, mining was seen as really the only feasible method of extracting bitumen from the sand. So the Alberta government and oil companies at the time estimated that some maybe around, you know, 5-6% of the total amount of the oil sands was exploitable using mining. So the other 95% or so would either have to be not developed at all, or if it was going to be developed, it would have to be developed some other way. At the time, there were various methods of in situ production. That's production in place that were being used, mostly involving the injection of steam into formations. And there was some sense that maybe some of these could be applied in the oil sands, but nothing very much had come of them to date. So there was this huge resource sitting out there, and there was this sense that they had to find some way to develop it.
So who was the one with the brilliant idea who brought it forward to the Alberta government?
Well, the key figure in this story is a man by the name of Dr. M.L. Natland, who was the manager for production research for an American oil company, the Richfield Oil Corporation. And according to an article that Natland later on wrote for publication about the development of this engineering idea and his ongoing belief in its value and prospects, he came up with the idea, and he first thought about the idea of using nuclear energy to release otherwise trapped oil while he was working in southern Arabia. And he, according to a rather dramatic description of how this all occurred, he says he was sitting on a small hill and he watched the huge orb of the sun sinking below the sands. And he thought to himself, the sun is a thermonuclear power source. Maybe we can use something similar to develop oil resources around the world. He wasn't alone in these ideas. The United States Atomic Energy Commission had also, there were other people working with them who had thought about this idea. And there are some suggestions in the literature that I've looked at that in the Soviet Union that they'd experimented with something similar of using nuclear devices to stimulate oil and gas production. And in fairness, it should be mentioned that in 1967, as part of Project Plowshares, the United States actually engaged in two projects, one called Project Gas Buggy and the other called Project Rollison, or Rulison, which were underground nuclear explosions which were set off to stimulate gas production in gas reserves that were known and identified but which were difficult to exploit for one reason or another. And the idea was that this would break up the rock in which the gas was entrapped.
That was historian Dr. Michael Payne, the head of research and publications for the Historic Sites and Cultural Facilities branch of Alberta Community Development. He'll continue his story next week. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this Science Heritage segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can catch up on past programs by clicking on our website. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.